Hey guys, Becky Quick here, and boy do I have a treat for you. I'm back to share a few bonus episodes of Squawk Pod from our annual Ask Warren interview special with the Oracle of Omaha himself, Warren Buffett. We talk succession planning, big bets, election 2020, and so much more. I'm sharing an episode with you now, but be sure to subscribe to Squawk Pod today for even more. And stay subscribed to this feed too, because we'll have more for you in the coming months. But for now, listen in to the Squawk Pod.
Yep, here's Warren, ready to go, on time.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's Essential Morning Show.
PCR 2.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today on Squawk Pod, Warren Buffett sits down with Becky Quick.
How are you?
Good. Doing fine.
The 89-year-old CEO and chairman of Berkshire Hathaway has written his annual letter to shareholders. It's read by millions, but written for two.
I've always had the image that I am talking to my sisters. I have two sisters, and I pretend they've been away for a year, and I'm reporting to them on their investment. So it's Dear Doris and Bertie.
After 55 of those letters, Warren Buffett is still as hungry for stocks today as he ever was.
First day I bought stocks was March 12, 1942. There have been seven Republicans after that and seven Democrats. I bought stocks under every one of them.
This is a special, super-sized podcast with the Oracle of Omaha on thoughtful investing.
You get more trouble with a good idea than a bad idea because the good idea works.
American politics.
You're not a card-carrying Democrat.
That's true.
You are a card-carrying capitalist. You
absolutely
actually have one of those in your wallet.
Yeah.
And only on Squawk Pod, Warren Buffett's own podcast feed.
I didn't really think I was going to listen to all 30 minutes, but it was really good.
I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Monday, February 24th, 2020. Squawk Pod with Warren Buffett begins right now.
Hi, this is Becky Quick, and today I'm live in Omaha, Nebraska with a very special edition of Squawk Pod. We've been speaking with Warren Buffett, the chairman and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway. This is what we call our Ask Warren show, and believe it or not, this is something we've done for now 13 years running. We meet with him on the Monday after he releases his shareholders' letter, his annual shareholders' letter, and we take questions from viewers. We've gotten thousands and thousands of questions from viewers over the years, and we've tried to ask them as many as we possibly can. Nothing's off limits for this conversation. We talk about everything from interest rates to the Berkshire Hathaway companies to the investments in companies like Apple. This time was a little unusual, though. We were starting looking at the market down 800-plus points in the morning before the market opened, so these are the things that we got to bounce off with him right off the top.
We're a net buyer of stocks over time, and just like being a net buyer of food, I expect to buy food the rest of my life, and I hope that food goes down in price tomorrow. So when stocks are down, we're going to be buying on balance, and who wouldn't rather buy it, at a lower price than a higher price? People are really strange on that. I mean, they because most your listeners are savers, and that means they'll be net buyers, and they should want the stock market to go down. They should want to buy at a lower price. But they got that feeling that they just feel better when stocks are going up.
I want to talk about the letter. Obviously, one of the things that you touch on in the level on the letter is when people should be buying stocks.
The very first day I bought stocks was March 12, 1941, 42. And the stocks were down about 2% that day, as it turned out. Unfortunately, I bought in the morning, so when I came home in the evening and my dad told me the execution price, it was down 2%. But if you're buying a business, and that's what stocks are, businesses. In fact, people will be better off if they say, I bought a business today, not a stock today, because that gives you a different perspective on it. Then presumably you're in the buy a farm, if you buy an apartment house, if you buy a business, you're going to own it for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And the real question is has the 10-year or 20-year outlook for American businesses changed in the last 24 hours or 48 hours? And you'll notice many of the businesses we own, partially own, American Express, we've owned it for 20 years, Coca-Cola, we've owned it for 40 years. Those are businesses. And buy or sell your business based on today's headlines. And if it gives you a chance to buy something that you like and you can buy it even cheaper, then it's your good luck, basically.
Does that mean Berkshire will be buying stocks today?
Well, we certainly won't be selling. We could easily be buying something, sure.
In the letter this year, you highlighted a book that was written by Edgar Lawrence Smith back in 1924. And you said until he came along, nobody really realized the compound interest effect of buying stocks, not just buying businesses, but buying stocks themselves.
Yeah. Edgar Lawrence Smith changed the world with that book, and the people have forgotten all about it now. Although in the 1920s, it became more and more gospel as the boom went on. But Edgar Lawrence Smith set out to write a book on bonds versus stocks. And he said he went in with the idea that bonds would be a better investment in times of deflation and stocks would be a better investment in times of inflation. And the first line of his book was to say that he'd been wrong, but he had enough sense to look at his evidence. I think Darwin said if you found evidence that was contrary to what you already believed, write it down in 30 minutes or your mind will just block it out. I mean, people have a great resistance to new evidence. And he said, if a stock yields 4%, a bond yields 4%, which was what he was talking about then, the stock was going to outperform the bonds because there were retained earnings that were building beyond that yield. And that had been true for a long, long time, but nobody paid any attention to it. We don't get rich on our dividends that we receive, although we're happy to receive them. We get rich on the fact that the retained earnings are used to build new earning power, repurchase shares, which increases your ownership in the company, and Berkshire has retained earnings ever since we started. That's the only reason Berkshire's worth a lot more as we retain earnings.
That led Keynes to actually say that this was an important book. People paid attention to it, but you're right, it added to the frenzy that built up to 1929.
Well, that is true, because you can get, old boss Ben Graham told me very early on, you get more trouble with a good idea than a bad idea, because the good idea works. I mean, it's a good idea to buy a home, for example, and then people go crazy. The good idea works, and it works, and it works. Stocks work out better than bonds most of the time. And after a while, people forget that there were some other limiting conditions. With Edgar Lawrence Smith's book, it was that when bonds yield the same as stocks, which was the case then, that stocks are going to outperform because they have this retained earnings. So stocks started going up in the 20s, and all of a sudden they were selling at five or six times the prices as when he bought the book. And the original correct perception on his part had experienced changing conditions, but people just looked. They got their confirmation through stock prices. And people, that's what happens in bull markets. People start out thinking stocks are cheap, and then they start thinking stocks have gone up. And a stock can be a good buy or a bad buy. A bond can be a good buy or a bad buy. It depends on price.
But that leads us to today. I mean, if his premise was that stocks are always going to be a better investment than bonds, that's kind of what you hear today, which we've been hearing for a while, is, Tina, there is no alternative, right? You have to buy stocks because bond yields are so low, because interest rates are so low.
Well, if you look at the present situation, we've talked about this before, that you get more for your money in stocks than bonds. That doesn't have to be the case. I mean, but it's usually been the case in America, very usually been the case. And if you buy a 30-year bond today with a yield 2%, you're paying 50 times earnings for an investment where the earnings can't go up for 30 years. Now, if somebody said, I want to sell you a stock that's at 50 times earnings and the earnings can't go up for 30 years, you'd say that doesn't sound very good. Stocks are way better than 30-year bonds. I mean, that's clear. And that's one of the alternatives people have. People really have three basic alternatives: short-term cash, which is an option of doing something later on, long-term bonds or long-term stocks, and stocks are cheaper than bonds.
Charlie said recently, Charlie Munger, the vice chairman at Berkshire Hathaway, had his Daily Journal meeting just a couple of weeks ago, and at that meeting he said that there's a lot of wretched excess out there and that there's a lot of trouble coming as a result. Do you agree with that?
There's always trouble coming. Yeah, there was trouble coming in 1942 when I bought that first stock, all kinds of trouble. Philippines were going to fall pretty soon. There's all kinds of trouble in 1949. There was trouble, certainly trouble in 2008 when I wrote an article for the New York Times. I said trouble is coming, but I said buy stocks.
Would you repeat that this time? If trouble's coming, would you still say buy stocks right now?
I would say buy stocks if you get enough for your money. And, you know, we buy a few stocks, but we don't look at, we're not buying the stock market. We're saying, I am buying, let's say American Express. We own American Express. You know, there's 815 million shares out, and sells at This morning it's 126 or something like that. So it's selling for roughly $100 billion. Now, the real question is whether the company is worth more or less than $100 billion. It isn't what the stock is going to do tomorrow or next week or next month.
You said just a few minutes ago, right now Berkshire Hathaway is a net buyer of stocks. You are in a net buying position?
We've been a net buyer of stocks, or I've been actually been a personal net buyer of stocks ever since I was 11, every year. There's been 15 American presidents in my lifetime, more than a third. I've lived under a third of the life. I didn't buy stocks under Hoover. I was only about 6 months old then. But there have been seven Republicans after that and seven Democrats. I bought stocks under every one of them. Now, I haven't bought stocks every day. There have been a few times I've thought stocks were really quite high. And I've even written an article once or twice, but that's very seldom.
But you wrapped up your partnership at one point,
I wrapped up my partnership once.
Because you thought it was too expensive.
Yeah.
Okay. But this is not a time like that?
We own $240 billion worth of stocks. Now, we look at that as $240 billion worth of businesses that we own parts of. But I love owning those businesses.
You've also got more than $125 billion in cash sitting around.
Yeah, well, we'd like to buy more businesses.
So there are a lot of people who look at the market and they say, look, I want to buy, but I don't want to buy when the market's sitting at new highs, when it's been hitting new records every day. Maybe there's more of a decline to come because the effect of the coronavirus is going to be an impact on the global economy. IMF said that over the weekend. You are going to see weakness as not only China, but other countries try and address this. You're right. It may not change things over the 5 or 10 year span of things. But if I think that I can buy something for potentially 10% cheaper, maybe more than that, if I wait a week or a month, maybe that's what I'm sitting around.
Well, if you think that, then you're going to get fabulously rich if you're right. All you have to do is just keep buying at 10 day intervals and keep taking your 10 day prediction. If I knew what the market was going to do, obviously, but you don't. I don't think anybody knows what the market's going to do. I think you do know whether you're making an intelligent purchase at a given price. Everybody, when they buy a stock, if you're going to buy, say, General Motors that has 1,400,000,000 shares out, you should be able to take a yellow pad like you have there, and on one page, say, let's say it's selling for 30. It isn't selling that low, but that'd be $42 billion. You should say, I am buying the General Motors company for $42 billion because, and you should get it on a piece of paper. And then if you want to have a separate piece of paper, it says, I think I know what the stock market's going to do, so I know whether it'll be higher or lower in it. But you don't. You don't have that.
But if I worry that the economy is going to slow down, not just for the quarter, but for the year, that would impact how many cars I think they might be able to sell or even produce.
I'll guarantee you cars are going to slow down someday. In 1932, General Motors had 19,000 dealers. That's more than all the auto dealers in the United States today. There were only 125 million people then, but they had 19,000 dealers. They produced or sold, and there was 1 month, I think, when they sold less than a tenth of a car, right at a tenth of a car per dealer. That was a terrific time to buy General Motors. forget about the market. If you can predict the market, you don't need to read balance sheets. You don't need to read anything. You certainly can't predict the market by reading the daily newspaper. That is for sure. And you really can't. You certainly can't predict the market by listening to me. But you're buying businesses. And if you had planned to buy a local service station yesterday and it was closing today, I don't think you'd tear your hair out or anything like that. You'd have already looked at where it was located and the contract that it had with the suppliers and made a decision on competition. People, because they can make decisions every second in stocks, whereas they can't with farms, they think an investment in stocks is different than an investment in a business or an investment in a farm or investment in an apartment house. But it isn't. If you get your money's worth in terms of future earning power over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, you're going to have made a good investment. And you can't pick them from day to day. If you can do that, you can. Well, I haven't met anybody yet that knows how to do it.
People have a lot of questions about the economy. They're wondering what's happening right now, particularly with the coronavirus out there. You have a lot of economic data at your fingertips because not only are the many businesses that Berkshire owns, but the businesses you own pieces in. What are you seeing right now around the globe?
Well, it affects various businesses. I would say that I received commentary. I get some commentary monthly from almost all of the companies, and a good many of them had some comment about how it was affecting them, and however it was affecting them at that time, I'm sure it's accentuated. But they've been affected by, they were affected by tariffs, they're affected by taxes, they're affected by, the most thing is they're affected by competitors and supply and demand over time. And I don't have the faintest idea what our businesses will be doing 6 months from now or 12 months from now. I do think that not only our businesses, but American business generally, will be doing fabulously better 30 years from now or 20 years from now. And the long term is very, in my view, is very easy to predict in a general way, but an important way. I don't think there's any way to predict what the stock market will do 10 minutes from now, 10 days from now, or 10 months from now. So I work on what I think I'm able to do. And as desirable as it might be to know what was going to happen 10 minutes from now, that's just not something I'll ever be able to master. So fortunately, I can come to a pretty firm conclusion that 20 or 30 years from now, America business and probably over the world will be far better than it is now.
What are the momentary implications that you've seen from coronavirus? What's an example of a business?
Well, an example, for example, we have maybe 1,000 Dairy Queen franchises in China here, and they're just treat only, so they're the older type, not with food. But a great number of them were closed, but the ones that were open weren't doing any business to speak of. And Apple is, I mean, our much bigger holding is Apple. We own 5.6% of Apple, and the company came out and said that it's affecting not only its stores but all kinds of things, supply chain. And I find that certain of our companies have got supply chain arrangements that are being affected by this that I didn't even know had those.
Like what?
Well, I got one from Johns Manville the other day, for example. You wouldn't normally think of them as having a big supply chain, but Shaw Carpets or you name it. I'll guarantee you that a very significant percentage of our business is one layer affected by it. But they're being affected by a lot of other things, too. And the real question is where are those businesses going to be in 5 or 10 years? Sure. They'll have ups and downs. Our candy business is a wonderful business, but it loses money 7 months out of the year. But the nice thing is Christmas comes every year.
It's warm weather. We're approaching spring in a lot of parts of the country, or a lot of parts of the planet. That may be good news. We just don't know if this time around, if this is one of those viruses that does die off in warmer weather. Wait and see and kind of hope.
Yeah, warm actually, I think this, from what I've heard from people that know a lot more about viruses than I do, that unfortunately this will make it through the summer, and in terms of having a vaccine, it's, you know, a long ways off. So you've got, you know, it is scary stuff. I don't think it should affect what you do in stocks, but in terms of the human race, it's scary stuff when you have a pandemic.
Yeah, I guess this one's particularly frightening because it's new. So there's no natural immunity that's built up in any of the populations. And you wonder what happens, particularly in areas where there's not the same healthcare structure that we have in America or in some of the developed nations. I guess that's a big part of the question, too.
Yeah. And it's I think about it in terms of our annual meeting, I mean, which is May 2nd. I mean, it could very well affect by that time. It could affect.
We've got questions from viewers asking just that. Will the annual meeting be any different this year, particularly because you have a large Chinese contingency of shareholders who
Yeah, and that certainly will be affected. And incidentally, I mean, flu is particularly tough on old people. If you're going to have two guys on the stage whose combined age is 185. So we won't be looking for people that are showing any signs of contagion. But that's one of the problems with this, is it does have a long gestation period, and it's highly transmissible.
And again, you did talk about it earlier. It's something that you see in the results of the businesses, some of your own fully owned businesses that you didn't anticipate.
Well, and we own airlines, for example. It affects businesses. Now, actually, my dad used to tell me stories. He was 14 in 1918, and he told me what went on in Omaha, you know, during the big Spanish flu epidemic. I mean, it was something in those days, and pandemics will occur in the future. Now, what they hope to get is a universal flu vaccine, but that's a long way off. It isn't impossible. I mean, I asked my own science advisor is Bill Gates, so I talked to him. I call him. I've talked to him the last few days about it, and he's bullish on the long-term outlook for a universal prevention of it. But he says it's not going to come, it's not going to be here in 10 years.
What are Bill's concerns as somebody who spends a lot of time traveling around the globe, as somebody who is trying to help medicine in some of the less developed parts of the world?
Yeah, the Gates Foundation is very active in trying to be helpful on this. And Bill says the CDC is the best in the world. And we've got terrific resources in this country, but a pandemic is a pandemic. There's just no evaluating. But I have heard that the summer is not likely to cause the end of this.
Do you know why?
But I don't know. And you shouldn't be asking. I shouldn't be offering my opinion on that, because I pass along things I hear from people I think are smart. But
I'm actually asking for Bill's opinion, not yours.
Well, I shouldn't. And I shouldn't really quote him. But I do. He's the guy I ask. I did talk to him just a few days ago. He loves to talk science, and he can make it so I can understand it, which is quite a trick. At the Gates Foundation, they're taking it very seriously, I'll put it that way.
Is money going from the Gates Foundation to try and find a vaccine?
I'm sure we're expending human and financial resources.
When you look at the economy and how things were kind of chugging along, let's say, beginning of this year,
when things
first picked up, how would you gauge the U.S. economy at that
point? Well, it's strong, but a little softer than it was 6 months ago, but that's over a broad range of business. You look at car loadings, rail car loadings, that's moving goods around. And there again, that was affected by the tariffs too, because people front-ended purchases, all kinds of things, always a lot of variables. But business is down, but it's down from a very good level. So I would say that looking at our 70 businesses, and that actually, they represent hundreds in addition. They're a little softer. On the other hand, I was out with the fellows from the Nebraska Furniture Mart just Saturday night, and their business was up quite a bit in February, but that's because weather was good. So you have a lot of variables that hit.
Why do you think business was down, let's say, the last 6 months? Is it a decline in confidence, or is it coming off of levels where there was unusual activity ahead of that?
Well, it isn't really down. It's just it leveled off and a little softer maybe now. But tariffs, the tariff situation was a big question mark for all kinds of companies, and still is to some degree. But that was front and center for a while. Now coronavirus is front and center. Something else will be front and center 6 months from now, and a year from now, and 2 years from now. The real question is where are these businesses going to be 5 and 10 and 20 years from now? Some of them will do sensationally. Some of them will disappear. And overall, I think America will do very well. It has since 1776.
But you still watch things like rail car loadings very closely.
I watch everything. But I don't do it to make specific investment decisions. But I enjoy it. I want to know what's going on, but I also don't think that I can make money by predicting what's going to go on next week or next month. I do think I can make money by predicting what's going to happen in 10 years.
All right. Well, tell us more about what's going on, just since you like knowing about those things.
Well, as I say, certain businesses depend on weather to quite an extent in retail, for example, in given months. But the big trends you see are going on. I mean, in terms of the movement to online commerce, and I mean, the big stuff keeps moving. But we've got a big investment in the airline business, and I just heard, even more flights are canceled and all that. But flights are canceled for weather. It so happens in this case they're going to be canceled for longer because of coronavirus. But if you own airlines for 10 or 20 years, you're going to have some of ups and downs in current business, and some of them will be weather-related, and they can be all kinds of things. The real question is how many passengers are they going to be carrying 10 years from now and 15 years from now, and what will margins be, and what will the competitive position be? But I still look at the figures all the time. I'll admit that.
You mentioned the airlines, and you own stakes in all the major airlines.
All four.
None as much as Delta. I think you own north of 11% of Delta at this point?
Well, our largest position is in Delta. Three of the four positions are mine. One of the positions is one of the other fellows. of the four positions. But we own a very roughly close to 10% of the four largest airlines.
There's been a lot of speculation. In fact, some of the questions that came in over this weekend were questions about those airlines, wondering if you would buy any of them outright. Have you considered buying any of those companies outright?
It'd be very unlikely we would do that. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, for one thing, they're regulated, and there's an interplay. I'll just give you an example, not that we'd be doing, but with Delta, we own 18% of American Express, and American Express is a bank holding company, and bank holding companies have limits as to what they can do, and we're a passive holder of a bank holding company with American Express. But then if we owned an airline that was tied up with them, they'd have lots of arrangements. There's a lot of complications because it's a regulated industry. Anytime you get in a regulated industry, you have more complications in transactions.
So is it fair to say you like these stocks and you would own more if it wasn't complicated?
Well, to go beyond 15% in any company, we would have to go in on Hart-Scott-Rodino. I mean, there's a lot of rules as you increase your ownership. Obviously, almost anything we own, we'd like to own more of.
Are you buying more of any of those stakes right now? Apple
stocks? Right. I get pretty close-mouthed when it comes to what we're buying.
All of a sudden, I feel
my jaws lock up.
Everything you just heard was on Squawk Box this morning. But this is Squawk Pod, which means special content just for you, our podcast listeners. And as it turns out, Warren Buffett may be among you.
He is popular. We keep getting more downloads every day.
Terrific. Okay.
So, Warren, first of all, let me ask you, do you ever listen to podcasts?
I've listened to maybe 4 or 5. It's kind of a slow method of communication, so it's not really efficient in my case, usually. But my friend Carol Loomis has been on a podcast with David Novak, I believe, and Tom Murphy the same way. And so if Charlie Munger did a podcast, I'd probably run it 5 times. Yeah, but I'm not a regular listener.
But you know how, and you've done it.
I've done it, and I did it just the other day because I looked on Google and I saw that one of our managers, a remarkable guy, had done a podcast. And so I went to Iowa Public TV, and this guy's name is Adam Wright, and I listened to a 38-minute podcast, and I didn't really think I was going to listen to all 38 minutes, but it was really good.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, Warren Buffett defends the size of $500 billion-plus Berkshire Hathaway.
Wall Street would love to come along and sell anything that we've got.
And his legacy investors. A Class A share of Berkshire is worth more than $300,000.
I love the shareholders we have.
We'll be right back. You're listening to a special extended episode of Squawk Pod. Becky Quick interviews legendary investor Warren Buffett. And here's a podcast exclusive clip about Buffett's unorthodox betting strategy.
A story that you and I have talked about in the past, but it's the story of the non-transitive dice and what you do with that. Uh-huh. Like, it's something you used when you first met Bill Gates, right? Or at some point you kind of pulled
right,
them out.
Right.
What happened?
Well, I read about them in the Scientific Journal, these non-transitive dice, where I bet you, I give you a choice of 4 dice, and you can pick one, and then we'll roll against one I pick, and the higher number wins. And whatever you pick, I can beat you, which sounds crazy, because if I'm taller than you and some basketball player's taller than I am, he's taller than you. That's a transitive series. But these dice are non-transitive, and so you can go to bars and you can go to restaurants and you can roll for the who pays for the check, and you can go through life and never pick up a check if you have these non-transitive dice, which I have. And only three times people figured it out and said, "You pick first," to me. And one was a drunk I met someplace, and the other two were Sal Krupke from Omaha, became one of the most famous guys in a certain field of language, and Bill Gates. And those guys both said, "You go first." And at that point, I just went on to somebody else.
Let's talk a little bit about a Barron's cover story that was just out last week. The good news on the cover story is they think the Berkshire is worth more than it's selling for right now. The bad news is they said they think that's in part because it's got a big conglomerate discount, and they think if you weren't running it, that it might get broken up. What's your response to that line of logic?
Well, conglomerates have had a bad name, and for good reason, over the years. I mean, I closed my partnership up at the end of the 1960s, and there was a very abusive run in conglomerates where they played with numbers and they had dirty pooling, as they called it, of accounting. They wanted to have their stocks up and put out stories to do it so they could issue more stock. They were kind of chain letter arrangements. There have been a lot of bad conglomerates, and probably disproportionately so compared to sort of honest to God single industry businesses over time. We don't think we're that kind of a conglomerate. We've certainly never wanted to issue shares. We've never touted shares. It's done for business reasons in our case. The interesting thing is, of course, is the American public has been going wild in their enthusiasm for conglomerates in the last few years, if you think about it. I mean, it's been an incredibly popular area. But they call them index funds.
Oh.
You buy 500 businesses.
I'm trying to figure out what you were talking
about. Yeah, well, 500 businesses all put together. I mean, that's the ultimate conglomerate, isn't it?
I mean, I've
recommended index funds to lots of people, and when they do it, they're buying into 500 businesses. And they're going to have 500 businesses a year from now and 5 years from now, and they think that group of businesses will do very well, and I think our group of businesses will do okay.
The difference with an S&P 500 index is it's 500 different companies run by 500 different management teams who are all focused on their business, maybe not having a centralized operation that is loosely running all of those businesses.
Well, our businesses are run by separate people. I mean, we just finished Valentine's Day, and I did not select what pieces went in the boxes. It's been probably been 10 years at least since I've been to a See's Candy factory. Now, you know, I get the figures every month, but I don't know how to make chocolate, anything of the sort. I don't pick out the new locations. We have managers for our businesses that are very much like the managers we have for the businesses that we own pieces of, like American Express or Coca-Cola. And there's a couple things we can do. We can determine the dividend policy of our subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
We can control their capital allocation to some extent, but on most capital allocation, whether to buy new equipment or anything like that, they make the decision. The BNSF Railroad is going to spend $3.5 billion on. I don't approve a single dollar of that in terms of capital expenditures. They know what they need to do, where they need to lay track, how many locomotives they need, whatever it may be. So our managers are, I would say, in a sense, they're almost more independent than the managers of the S&P 500 who go around and report to Wall Street week after week. They go to an investor relations meeting, and they're always explaining what they're doing and trying to get the approval of the analysts and all that sort of thing. And we just tell our managers to do what makes sense.
Okay, outside of the idea of them not having to report to individual shareholders or the investment community, what's the advantage of having you there, the capital allocation part of it?
Well, we can move capital within. If you move capital from one stock to another, and you got a gain, particularly, I mean, you pay a tax, and may pay a dividend tax, or if you sell, but there's a lot of taxes incurred in moving from one business to another, either at the corporate level, in some cases, but certainly at the individual level, and we can move capital. Well, just take See's Candy again. We bought that in 1972. We've moved several billion dollars from the candy business to other types of businesses. And we'd love it if we could use it all in the candy business, but it just isn't that sort of business. And in addition to that, we free up our managers from all dealing with Wall Street, dealing with bankers, dealing with all kinds of things that are what I regard as less productive use of their time.
However, you also have a situation where you have gotten some activists who have been interested in the stock, including Bill Ackman. He's built up a stake, hasn't said too much about it, but I think he has made some comments about how maybe Burlington Northern Santa Fe's margins could be improved. You can look back at Bill Ackman's experience with the Canadian Pacific Railway and kind of wonder if he is building up a position because he would like to see you take a more active role there.
Well, we notice what other railroads earn and when their margins are better. I mean, and we certainly put way less pressure on than Wall Street might, who would want it next week. Our managers are well aware of what's going on in other industries, and we've made changes where we don't think some businesses are performing as well as they should. But overwhelmingly, we've got managers there that are very, very good. They've got capital available to them for anything that makes sense. And we decide how much they distribute, where the capital moves, and sometimes it moves from one industry to another. And in certain industries, a consolidated tax position really is very helpful to us.
There's a viewer question that came in from Ben Comston, and he asks, it was recently pointed out by Bill Ackman that some subsidiaries like GEICO, BNSF, lag their peers in some areas. Would you agree with that? And how can your successor push improvement in subsidiaries while maintaining a decentralized management structure?
Well, at GEICO, we bought control in 1995. We had about 2.5% of the market for auto insurance, and we're at about 13.7% of the market. So we've gone from $2.5 billion of premium volume or thereabouts to $35 billion of premium volume. We're number two now to State Farm. We were number six or seven at that time. So I would say that not due to Berkshire at all, but due to Tony Nicely during almost all those years, GEICO has been the envy of every other company in the auto insurance business, except for Progressive, but they've done a good job, too. But GEICO is worth tens and tens and tens of billions more than when we bought it, in addition to all the earnings we've given, just the goodwill value. So that's been extraordinarily well run. And with Burlington, I think we paid a dividend of $5 billion last year, and we paid $35 billion for it. So it's gained in market share in its business. Its operating margins have improved, but they haven't improved as much as some other railroads.
Let's talk a little bit about Berkshire Hathaway. There has been this question raised, not only by Barron's in the cover story there, but by other places too, about whether Berkshire Hathaway would be worth more if it were split up.
That's a good question, and I will tell you that if you were to say, and let's say the stock market didn't change for 2 years and interest rates didn't change, so you had a two-year period and you said, we'll sell off all the businesses. Mm-hmm. You have the expenses of selling them. Now, if you sold them all to people who leveraged them up to their maximum, you might get a little more than the stock is selling for. It would be very tax inefficient, very tax inefficient. Interestingly enough, up till 1986, it wouldn't have been. I mean, there was a general utilities doctrine that governed corporate breakups. And so you could dispose of businesses or securities, if you did it right, you could dispose of securities or businesses that had appreciated without a tax at the corporate level. That was done regularly in various ways up till 1986. They revised the tax code big time. They killed general utilities. And you can't do that now. Now, you can have spinoffs, this business or that business. You probably have to lie a little in terms of your purpose in order to get the best tax ruling. And it takes time. But you cannot break up. You cannot dispose of the entire business business by business without having very substantial tax liability. It would not produce a gain. On the other hand, having them together produces, there's some very valuable synergies in there. Now, we don't use leverage as much as the people who would buy them piece by piece would do. So we could leverage Berkshire up to the sky. I've promised people we won't, because we have insurance promises to people out 50 or 100 years, and we've got shareholders who are going to own the stock for 50 years, and they do not want us to leverage to the sky. But there would not be a profit if we were simply to announce that over the next 24 months that you could come in and buy any business we had and we'd sell them to the highest bidder.
You made a point of talking about this in the annual letter.
Yeah.
You said key to my Berkshire only institutions is my faith in the future judgment and fidelity of Berkshire directors. They will regularly be tested by Wall Streeters bearing fees. At many companies, these super salesmen might win. I do not, however, expect this to happen.
That's exactly true. And I think by writing it, it helps it a little, too. No, there's no question that Wall Street would love to come along and sell anything that we've got. I mean, you know, there's a fee every time that there's a transaction, and they're big fees, and there's fees for financing. I mean, so we've had all kinds of people snoop around that. They know they're not getting it done with me, but it won't get done later on either. I am leaving. Every share of Berkshire I have goes to charity, and it's 99% of my net worth. So I got nobody cares more than I do about getting the most money to those philanthropies over the years following my death. And that's going to take place over 15 years. And I say keep it all in Berkshire. But if I thought that it was going to be run in a way responsive to Wall Street, I would instead do something else and have the money distributed to these philanthropies and not have it all tied to Berkshire. But Berkshire has a very unusual shareholder base. I mean, we have individuals that own Berkshire, and a lot of them have owned it 50 years, just like it's people buy it to own for lifetime, and we're going to run it in a way that they won't be disappointed in.
Do you think the people who are relatively newer shareholders buying the B shares have the same mentality as the people who have been in it for 50 years in the A?
Well, we try to, because that's who we encourage. I mean, in effect, we don't want everybody to buy our stock. I mean, there's only so many seats. There's about 1,600,000+ A shares out. All the seats are filled. I love the shareholders we have. I don't want to go to Wall Street and try and get some new shareholders. They're going to replace the people we have. So what we want to have is people in those seats that are in sync with us. You can run a French restaurant or you can run a hamburger stand. And if you serve good hamburgers, you'll do good business at the hamburger stand. You can, at the French restaurant, do the same thing there. But you can't run the French restaurant and then serve hamburgers inside. And you can't run the hamburger stand and serve French food inside. So we advertise in our deeds, in our words, in every way we can, what we're about. And we're looking to have the seats filled in our church by people who are in sync with us. And we do have them there. We get the same people every Sunday. And I see no advantage in going out and telling everybody in Wall Street we're going to do wonderful things and having those seats replaced. Because the only way you can get a seat is to throw somebody else out of that seat. There's only so many seats and they're all full. And you want them filled with people who are in sync with the policies of the company. And therefore, you have to explain those policies and you have to live up to those policies. And for 55 years, we've tried to.
So you get the shareholders you deserve.
Exactly.
All right, not to mix metaphors, but can you have a decentralized central office running both the French restaurant and the hamburger place?
Well, we're not trying to have the railroad management run the utility or anything.
We're decentralized, that's what I mean. A decentralized headquarters that's in charge, a conglomerate in charge of all those different businesses.
Well, we could run, we have decentralized management as it is. We could have somebody in charge of all the little companies, another one for the big. I mean, we could divisionalize it in all kinds of ways. I think we'd have more overhead. I think we'd have a different sort of manager. Our managers like running their own businesses, and they never have to finance their businesses. I mean, they never have to go to Wall Street. They probably save 25% of their time, and I want them to feel they own their businesses, and that's all they're responsible for. If we mess up some other way, you know, they get paid based on how they do, there again, we attract managers who like to operate on that basis. We don't attract managers, particularly, who think they're going to keep moving step by step through various divisions and eventually run the whole place.
All right, let's jump to Berkshire's overall record versus the S&P. Berkshire has now underperformed the S&P 500 on 1-year, 3-year, 5-year, and 10-year marks.
Yeah.
Is that because it's too big, and will it ever be able to outperform the
S&P? Well, certainly being too big is part of it. But I would say this, during that same time, I mean, last year, we achieved, now, I don't like it, GAAP earnings very well, but we achieved the highest GAAP earnings of any company in the world has ever achieved that's investor-owned. And we have the highest net worth of any company in the world investor-owned, any company in the world. So I would say, related to safety of principal over time, I feel good about it. And I feel good about the fact that 99% of my money's in it and that it will be the source of all the philanthropic contributions that are made for 15 or dozen years after I die. So, but I do not think it will be in the top 10% of stocks performing over the next 10 years. I don't think it'll be in the top 15% of stocks performing in the next 10 or 15 years. I also don't think it'll be in the bottom 10% or 20% or 30%. So, but our ability to have a huge edge over the market generally with a $550 billion market value, it'll be minor, but it'll be done in a very, very safe manner.
Is an investment in the S&P 500 a better investment
than Berkshire? It could be. On balance, I think we'll do a little better, but it'll be minor. It depends on the kind of market we're in. If we're in a down market, we're going to beat it. I mean, it's that simple. And sometimes we will be. The last 10 years, we haven't been. But over 55 years, it's worked, and it will continue working, but it will not work at all like it did when we were working with $100 million or $1 billion. There's no question about that. But we've got good businesses, and we won't be in the bottom quartile, I promise you that, over any long period of time.
There are people, like there were back in 1999, who have said maybe you've lost your edge. It was a similar thing in 1999 where you saw the technology stocks that were the big high flyers that people were pouring their money into, the dot-com companies and a lot of others associated with that. If you look at the markets again, it's the technology companies that have the big runs. This time you're participating in Apple, which is one of those front runners. But is this a cyclical thing to you? You think there'll be another market downturn and then Berkshire
There'll be a downturn sometime.
Berkshire outperforms at that point? Or?
Oh, we'll outperform in a down market, but that may not be particularly satisfactory to people. But no, we will because we have these businesses that are making money. And that, I mean, we're geared somewhat away from a full market participation in either direction. But that's fine. We own, if you think about it, we're 80-some percent in equities. We may show 230 or 40 billion in equities, and that looks like we're against our market cap. We're 40%, but we own 100% of these other businesses. Those are equities, too. I mean, we own a railroad, and we own insurance companies, and those are equities. So we're about 80% roughly in equities and about 20% in cash, and I'd rather have that 20% in other good businesses, that is to some extent a curse of size, and it's to some extent the fact that it's very hard. If interest rates stay at this level, we'll wish we'd, for the next 10 or 20 years, we'll wish we'd been 125% in equities. I mean, equities are so much cheaper than bonds, long bonds, that something will change in a major way. I just don't know what. And I want to be prepared for anything, obviously.
So that's why you keep so much cash around. You want to be able to be prepared for a downturn. You want to be prepared for a crisis.
We want to be prepared for anything, Becky. We want to be prepared for pandemics. We want to be prepared for anything comes along. Yeah, that is the chief job I have. I have people's money that gave it to me 50 or 60 years ago, and some of them still have 100% of their money or essentially in it. And the one thing... And I've got the responsibility for five foundations that presently are going to get $80 billion, and I think we'll get a lot more over time, probably. We don't want to permanently lose money. And you don't want to get that so that you go into a shell and don't do anything. But we have obligations to people on workers' compensation claims and auto accidents they've had that go out 50 years. And... You know, we have to run the place so that every check clears under any circumstances. And that's why, incidentally, we own treasury bills. We don't own commercial paper. We don't rely on bank lines or anything. When people get terrified, and they will occasionally, everything freezes. And you're going to have to stand on your own feet at a time like that. It won't happen very often, but it'll happen occasionally.
I know you've developed a thick skin over the years, but does it tick you off when people start questioning whether you've lost it, whether you can still...
Well, I'm sure I've lost some of it. I mean, I'll tell you all kinds of things I've lost. No, that happens. But we haven't lost GEICO or the railroads. Berkshire, without me, is worth essentially the same as Berkshire with me. I mean, my value added is not high, but I don't think I'm subtracting value. But the big thing is how our businesses do and what we get to add in the way of businesses over time. And we can add them through marketable securities. I mean, we own 5.5% or a little over percent of Apple. It's probably the best business I know in the world. And we own 5.5% of it. And that is a bigger commitment that we have in anything except insurance and the railroad. So it's our third largest business.
Yeah, you made the point that it was bigger than your biggest acquisition, Precision Castparts.
Oh, sure, no. It's our third largest business.
All right, let me test you on your thick skin.
Okay. Wow.
Here was the kicker of that Barron's cover story. He said, there's reasons to think that the company will be a market beater when he's gone. In the meantime, happy 90th.
Yeah, well, I hope it is a market beater when I'm gone. I'm counting on it. I'm telling my estate and then the trustees that succeed my executors in the estate, I'm telling them to keep every share of Berkshire they have until they have this pattern of giving it away. I mean, I want them to look back and say, gee, we should have made this change earlier. Because it's going to determine, you know, how much we buy in the way of vaccines and, you know, and all kinds of things, education, all these things. And I feel terrific about Berkshire after I leave.
Next, Warren Buffett on the 2020 Democratic race.
Wow, that's the first time I've ever heard you say something like that.
And new phone, who dis?
When did you get the smartphone?
You're looking at an 89-year-old guy that's barely beginning to be with it.
Warren, I want to talk about another issue that we have not touched on yet, and that's politics here in the United States. We just watched the Nevada caucus. Bernie Sanders walked away with the most delegates after that. He looks to be as the clear front runner for the nomination for the Democrats this time around. You have long been a supporter of the Democratic Party. What do you think?
Well, I think I'm going to wait and see who gets the nomination. But I'm a Democrat, but I'm not a card-carrying Democrat. I've voted for Republicans. I've contributed to Republicans. In fact, I've only run for two offices in my life. One was head of the Young Republicans at the University of Pennsylvania, and the other time I was actually on the ballot running for a delegate to the Republican National Convention in 1960. But normally I vote for Democrats, and we will see what happens.
Wow, that's the first time I've ever heard you say something like that.
Well, I've kept it a secret for all these years, but now it comes out.
You just said that you're not a card-carrying Democrat.
That's true.
You are a card-carrying capitalist. You
absolutely
actually have one of those in your wallet.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
I don't know whether I'm a card-carrying capitalist, right? I don't think that's inconsistent with what I've said on politics. Yeah, here it is. I think we will have some of those available at the annual meeting, too, for our shareholders.
This is a good time to remind podcast listeners that 1 year ago at the 2019 Ask Warren on Squawk Box, Buffett indicated he might support Mike Bloomberg for president. That was long before the former New York City mayor and fellow billionaire entered the race.
If Mike Bloomberg announced tomorrow that he was the candidate, I would say I'm for him. And I think he'd be a very good president.
So does Buffett feel the same today?
Well, I would certainly vote for him. I don't think another billionaire supporting him would be the best thing to announce. But sure, I would have no trouble voting for Mike Bloomberg. I would say this in terms of Sanders. I actually agree with him in terms of certain things he would like to accomplish. I don't agree with him in many ways. But in terms of the fact that we ought to do better by the people that get left behind by our capitalist system, I don't think we should kill the capital system in the process. I think we should make sure that the golden goose keeps laying more eggs, and it's worked wonderfully since 1776. But it doesn't work as well for people whose talents aren't really geared to a market economy. And I don't think anybody should be left behind by an economy that has over $60,000 of GDP per capita. And so I'm a big fan of increasing the earned income tax credit and I think there should be some changes made, but if given a choice, I would certainly vote for Mike Bloomberg as opposed to Sanders.
There is a plan. Let's talk about some of Sanders' plans. You said you agree with some of what his intentions are, but let's talk about some of those actual plans. One of those plans would be to give 20% of company stock to employees and put workers on the board. What do you think about that? That would be for any company, public company, that has more than $100 million in annual revenue or a $100 million balance sheet.
Well, I don't want to get involved in evaluating his whole plan, but I think that would be a particularly bad idea.
Because?
Well, I don't think putting 20% of the capitalists on a labor union support is a good idea either. And I think the market system works very, very well in terms of developing more goods and services. I mean, when you flew out here to Omaha, if you'd flown out here and you wouldn't have been able to fly in 1776, you wouldn't have seen anything. Everything you see is the product of a system that's worked like nothing's ever worked in the history of the world. So I do not believe in messing up our system of developing output. I do believe that anybody's willing to work 40 hours a week and has a couple kids should not have to have an extra second job. And I believe in having a higher income for people, not necessarily a higher minimum wage, but I do not think it's at all unreasonable that the income tax credit produces at least $15 an hour, maybe higher in certain areas. So I'm very much in sympathy with the fact that Senator Sanders believes that a lot of people are getting left behind and through no fault of their own. And there's all kinds of aspects of capitalism that can need in some ways to be regulated. But I don't believe in giving up the capitalistic system.
Let's talk about shares of Apple. With it being such a huge holding of yours, you've got more than 5.3% of the company right now?
Yeah, I think it's 5.6.
5.6%.
And it goes up every day.
Let's talk about what we've seen with the slowdown with the coronavirus, because Apple is one of the companies that has said it's going to have an impact, not only with the stores that they've closed there, with the behavior of Chinese customers, but also what happens with the supply chain.
Supply chain, sure.
How do you read through any of that? What are you hearing? Do you know more than we do on that front?
No, I don't know one thing more. I may see Tim Cook at the annual meeting. I see him in Sun Valley once a year. I don't think I've placed a phone call to Tim Cook in 2 or 3 years. All kinds of things are going to happen to Apple over the next 10 years. The real question is, what is the degree of pervasiveness and strength of that product 5 or 10 years from now? And I don't think of Apple as a stock. I think it's our third largest business.
It's also a high-flying technology company. It's one that's been at the forefront, but you've said in the past you didn't buy it because it's a technology company.
I think it's a consumer product. In fact, I think I said this on the program a couple of years ago. I mean, obviously it's a consumer product company that uses technology, but we've got a lot of products that use technology at Berkshire. But it's an incredible company, and I should have appreciated it earlier.
There's a question that came in from, I guess the handle is GPG. This is a question that came in on Twitter, and the writer asks, you've said that you can do fair value estimates of companies you follow at any time in your head. So please do one now for Apple. What went wrong with your estimate for IBM, and how is that miscalculation different than for Apple?
IBM's an entirely different business than Apple. I mean, Apple doesn't resemble IBM anymore. It resembles See's Candy in a way more. I mean, it is a incredibly useful product to people that grows more useful as the number of people are involved. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, we call them smartphones. If you go back and look at the old telephone, that was an incredible useful product. It changed my mother's life and my dad's life. It changed lives in every way, and they took a long time to become pervasive, and it was very expensive initially, but it changed the world. And the smartphone is part of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people's lives in all aspects of their lives. It's used as all kinds of utility. It's a consumer product.
Are you a consumer of its products at this point? You've had a flip phone for forever.
glad you brought that up. I am now using, not very often, I'm using the latest model, and I'll give you a little preview of our movie for the annual meeting. We haven't done it yet, but it will probably show me crushing with my foot, my old flip phone, while cozying up to the new smartphone.
When did you get the smartphone?
I've been given several of them, but including by Tim Cook.
One finally stuck?
Absolutely. No, I my flip phone is permanently gone. The number's been changed to my new phone.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
I mean, you're looking at an 89-year-old guy that's barely beginning to be with it.
Warren, I want to thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it, your generosity with your time, and we hope to see you again soon.
Come every year.
Thank you.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. On our rundown tomorrow, we continue to ask Warren, the Berkshire Hathaway chairman and CEO, on succession plans, his longtime partnership with 96-year-old vice chair Charlie Munger.
If Charlie Munger did a podcast, I'd probably run it five times, yeah.
And with the markets, Buffett says it's all about timing.
You should always adapt your consumption to your income. You shouldn't try and adjust your income to your consumption. That's a basic principle for individuals, businesses, and everything else.
Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every morning at 6 a.m. Eastern on CNBC. Our podcast is a hybrid. The best stories, debate, and analysis from our three-hour TV show right into your ears. You can subscribe to Squawk Pod for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen. Thoughts, comments, want to say hi? Tweet us at SquawkCNBC. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
I don't even know what time it is.
I have no idea.